BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to Dalek Radio. Dalek Radio for the week beginning Tuesday the 7th of October. Lots coming up on today's show. We've got some of the regulars. We have Sided with Rosie, read by the actor Malcolm Grieve. And we have The History of the Theatre in Bristol by Tony Gosling. We've also got an interview with Dr. Nazim on the dangers of being a Muslim non-extremist, also interviewed by Tony Gosling. And, well, how are you, Matthew Heap? I've got my co-presenter here.
I'm good, thank you. I've got to go to the dentist on Friday, but that's another story. We have later on an interview with Sam King from Compass of Mystery Theatre, which I'm particularly looking forward to. We've got music from David Bowie, The Gorillaz and Faithless.
Alrighty, so yes, good music, good tunes and all the local topics. Now time to hear an interview by Tony Gosling with Dr. Nazim. On the dangers of being a Muslim non-extremist.
It is dangerous not as far as other Muslims are concerned. I think it is dangerous with the secret services. And I say, for example, if Dr. Kelly can disappear under mysterious circumstances, I could disappear too. And there have been 5 incidents in my life. I was invited by a Christian charity to go to Afghanistan to examine their work. And I said, yes, they were going to pay my fare, and I said, okay, I will go, along with the Bishop of Birmingham. And I kept on ringing them, making inquiries, and one day I rang and I was told that the person who was my contact was not free because he was an MI5 officer who was visiting him at that time. Now that made me more suspicious. Then I studied the area where I was supposed to go. That was the most lawless area where there had been incidents of attacks and people being killed. So I thought it was prudent for me not to go. But I offered them the Imam, who is a Pashtun, and I thought he was better qualified for me from opposed to me, because he could speak the language of the people, he could understand, he could see their work much better, and he would bring back a better report than I could bring. He was not accepted. He had an interview, but he was dropped out. So that was one suspicious event in my life. Then I had an armed robbery. And the people did not seem to be interested in money or anything. The leader of the gang was on the phone all the time, as if he was giving them time to time picture of what was happening. I was tied up. I had sticky tape on my mouth. I was in my surgery. Then they decided to wheel me in the back room. And I thought that's where they're going to shoot me.
This is at the hospital, is it?
My surgery. What happened that the secretary of my colleague, who was working from my surgery and then moved to another, she was on the premises in the computer room searching for something. They were not aware of her presence. I was not aware of her presence. When she finished her work, she wanted to come into the room, and she saw these people blocking the way. They said, the man who was saying, you cannot go. She said, I'm going to come in. So she barged in. Then they, first of all, consulted on the phone what to do. They must have been given advice to lock her up somewhere. They tried to lock her up in the toilet. She said, I'm claustrophobic. I'm going to make a hell of a noise if you look. So then they on the phone again. She was tied up and taped. Then after another 15 minutes wait, they decided to go. They took my car keys, took my Jeep, and then dropped the Jeep some 60 yards away, and they disappeared. That was one incident. Then there, when the Lozelles riots happened, there was a clash between Muslims and people from Caribbean origin. I received a call from a very soft-spoken young person whose parents used to be my patients for a point of time. So he said that some of his colleagues wanted to come and talk to me. And I said, fine, you come and talk to me. Come to my surgery. My hours are such and such. He said, no, they cannot come in the daytime. They will come, like to come at the night time. I said, okay, you come at my surgery at the night. I finished surgery at 7 p.m. and that was winter, it was quite dark. He said, no, they don't want to come to your surgery. They gave me a location where they would wanted to see me. I became suspicious, I made inquiries, and that was an isolated house, in very bad repair. And I was advised by my friend that that is not a place that I should go on my own. So when they rang, I said, sorry, I cannot come there, but you come to the mosque. That was month of Ramadan, and there was evening prayer. So there was about at least 1,000 to 1,500 people here at that time. I said, you come there, and I will see you with your colleagues. And they said they will come, and they didn't turn up. So that confirmed my suspicion there was something wrong in this connection. A couple of weeks later, he rang me again. He said, we are having a meeting in one of the localities and we would like you to come. Because of the suspicion in my mind, at the time the meeting was on, I asked a friend of mine to go and see what the situation is. He rang me from his car. He said, there are a lot of young people here, and I would suggest, and they're all of Caribbean origin, and I would advise you not to come here. All I need is somebody to put a knife through me, and you can say, sorry, we can't control everybody. So I did not go. Then the police, the civil police, one day rang me and they said, we want to see you urgently. I said, what is the matter? And they said, your life is in danger. I said, come along. They came and said they have intercepted a conversation that chairman of the Birmingham Central Mosque was to be eliminated. And they put the panic buttons in my surgery, panic buttons in my residence, call system to get to direct if anything was suspicious. And it was 6 weeks' time, 6 or 8 weeks' time, which I was to be eliminated. I told the police that it's not likely to happen because you people have intercepted the call, and most likely they know that you have intercepted the call, and it is the rule of the game that when you are exposed, you drop the program. But they said, okay, keep all the things as they are, we shall see what happens. So after 6 or 8 weeks, nothing happened and I'm still alive. But that means, depending on what time, situation can change. At the moment, it seems I'm off the danger, but it can be revived any time. The moment I speak out or something really pinches them, then I think I'll be. One of the factors in my favor is that I'm 84 years old, and they may think, why bother with him? He's going to die anyway. So,
Muslims have been shown to have been involved in some kind of terrorist activity.
Yes, I think one of the ways the secret services work globally is to pick up people and list them under different pretexts. They do not know what the real game is. They are just tools to be used. And one of the classical cases, one person who was an MI5 agent in this country, when he went to Africa, the MI5 or MI6 informed CIA to arrest him, and he was arrested as a terrorist. It's from, as I see it, it's very easy. You have got ready information about somebody whom you have already recruited. You know all about him. The moment it happened, you can bring all the details. So-and-so, living in such and such place, doing this and this. And it's that speed which originally alerted me that something fishy here. You know the person, and you have, when the incident happened, you know when the incident is going to happen. And so you bring out all, and the general public thinks that secret services have done a marvelous job. One of the reasons the Birmingham is the safest place that we have done over the year, a lot of inter-community cohesion work. So it is difficult for here to sell the story that Muslims are the sources of danger. Because A, we are living amongst them, and a lot of them are mixed areas, and we have been working community cohesion. I mean, this mosque this gets about 10,000 visitors every year. There's a large number of people whom we are talking, and they're not the people who can easily be persuaded that something suddenly has happened, that we have turned into monsters.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Time for Matt's Muses.
Hello. A Tyneside pub has called time on one of its regulars after the premises were refurbished. Peggy, a 13-year-old mare, used to enjoy a pint of beer and a packet of crisps alongside her owner at the Alexandra Hotel in Jarrow. The horse now has to drink its pint outside whilst tethered to a post. This is because of the landlord's new carpets and her wish not to get them soiled. So what happens to a 13-year-old mare after drinking a pint? Does she have any preferences, I wonder? Or is it just her drinking what her owners drink? Is 13 years old quite old for a horse, or is it quite young? I've no idea. Isn't giving a horse a pint of beer against the law? Would it still be under the law if the horse was overage, or is it just underage horses that are illegal to give beer to? Can anyone take a horse into a bar and share a pint? Or is it just this pub? Does it have to be a horse, or how about a pet iguana? If this is legal, it probably stems from some ancient law harking back to a time when all men were allowed to enter a bar with a horse and order a pint. All those lonely nights away from their wives, a simple trip to London would have taken 3 days from Bristol, I reckon. And when you were feeling lonely, you couldn't simply phone up your wife. They say horses aren't very animated, but I reckon after a few pints of the right stuff, they would make perfect sense. Of course, everything back then was slower in those days, not like today when everybody's rushing around and getting stressed, like Brazilian Armando Clemente da Silva, for example. He's a man who likes driving everywhere fast, too busy to wait for red lights. He recently got pulled over by the police in Sao Paulo and had to explain why he was too busy to register his car 7 years ago. It's not a particularly impressive car either, 12 years old, only worth $6,500. I assume that's US dollars. Do they have Brazilian dollars? So what's $6,500 in our money? Anyway, I think the point is that this car was nothing special. It's been impounded, and when the police checked, they found that the car clocked up over 1,000 violations during the past 7 years, and this totaled a massive £1 million in traffic fines. Apparently, and I like this bit, Mr. Da Silva has been told he can have his car back so long as he pays the outstanding £1 million within 90 days. I'm not sure he likes his car that much, guys. See, this proves my point, I think. It's far better to slow down. The slow life is the best. If Mr. Da Silva had made friends with a horse, this would never have happened. Isn't it funny how we all pride ourselves on how far we think we've come since the days of travelling by horse and cart? And yet we still refer to the power of cars and the engines in cars in terms of horsepower. I don't think horsepower is used really in really powerful engines like jet engines in planes. You can have lots of fun in jet engines, especially if you're Swiss man Yves Rossi and you strap a few to your back and jump out of a plane. Has anyone seen that National Geographic video? It's really good. How much fun would that be to jump out of a plane with a wing strapped to your back and makeshift jets? Or would it be? Maybe you'd be bricking it. No, on reflection, I think I'd prefer something a bit slower. Maybe a pedal-powered flying ship, like the Frenchman has recently tried to cross the channel who failed. He was using an ET-inspired airship. But unlike the Rocket Man, he failed in his attempts because, get this, the winds exceeded 5 miles an hour. Well, that's hardly a gale, is it? Maybe if the Frenchman had designed his own airship with two seats, one for him and one, say, for a horse, well, that would be one horsepower plus his legs. Maybe he could have battled through those 5 mile an hour winds and shown that Rocket Man a thing or two. Generally, though, I reckon fast is bad. Take fast food, for example. That's bad. Everybody agrees. Well, except kids, that is. About 22 million of them in Europe are obese. That's a lot of obese kids. The thing is, a lot of those kids think that fast food is really great. They actually prefer the taste to normal food. That's why they're obese. This is bad news. But what's good news is that a lot of those kids actually love football. They idolise the top players. And this is something that the European Commission recognised, so they've been talking nicely to UEFA, and the result has been this healthy recipe book, which has been published by some of Europe's top footballers. For example, it turns out that Liverpool captain and England star Steven Gerrard's favourite recipe is aromatic sea bream. Scotland and Rangers captain, well, he likes a nice fruit salad. See, slow is good, fast is bad. It seems to me we are returning to good old-fashioned values. This is exactly the kind of food that Ozzetti would have liked. You don't know who Ozzetti is? He's that 5,300-year-old dead guy they found frozen up in the Italian Alps. He'd started his day with a meal in a wooded valley below the Alps before getting shot horribly in the back by a complete... I'm not allowed to use that word on radio, apparently. But anyway, he got shot in the back and the arrow pierced an artery and he bled to death. I bet he wasn't expecting that. Still, if he'd had a horse. Anyway, as I said, 5,300 years later, this hiking couple found his perfectly preserved body in a melting glacier and reported it. The couple got offered 5,200 euros for the body. That's the going rate, apparently, 25% of the discovery's value. But they weren't happy with this and they wanted more, which I think is a bit greedy. Anyway, the good news is that after 16 years of campaigning, the courts have finally agreed to pay out 1,500,000 euros. The bad news is that only one of the couple is still alive. Still more money for the widow, I suppose. Whatever you say about horses, they're polite, aren't they? I can't imagine any causing much fuss in a pub. They would just mind their own business and drink their pint. Even if someone tried to provoke them by telling them one of those horse-related jokes, such as a horse walks into a bar and orders a drink and the barman says, "Why the long face?" See, now you couldn't do that with an alligator. He wouldn't mind his own business. He'd rip your head off. No sense of humour, those alligators. If you told that joke to a Burmese python whilst he was enjoying his martini, he'd just strangle you and eat you as an hors d'oeuvre. But the horse, he'd stay well out of it. I reckon the Burmese python and the alligator, if they were having a drink in the same bar, they'd probably kick off. Alligator and python incidents are up at the moment. In Florida, Burmese pythons are really popular pets. Well, they are up until a point, presumably that point being when their dumb American owners suddenly realise what they've taken on. More and more of these pythons are being found in the wild in Florida, dumped by their owners. So, before the python turns up, who's the big daddy? Who's at the top of the food chain? Well, it's the alligator, isn't it? Not anymore. Now the python is on the scene, it's the perfect habitat for them, hot and steamy. So, one day the alligator is surveying his territory, lodging it up in front of all the other animals, and around the corner comes the python. All the other animals are thinking, who's going to win? The wardens are watching. They've seen these two species face off before, and even they don't know who's going to win. Apparently the animals are matched roughly 50-50. It all depends on who grabs hold of whom first. On this occasion, it's the python that gets the early advantage, and as he constricts, it's all over for the alligator. Now, this is where it all goes wrong for the python. And this is returning to my theme of slow is good and fast is bad. Instead of eating manageable chunks at a time, the python gets greedy and goes for the fast food option. He tries to eat the alligator whole in one sitting. Well, because snakes can dislocate their jaw bones, this python actually manages to swallow the alligator whole. Well, all the animals, including the rangers, leave to go home. It's all over. On this occasion, the python has won. But the alligator has the last laugh, because although he's not laughing, he isn't exactly dead either, just a trifle winded. During the night, the python starts to get some serious indigestion. Anyway, the wardens return the next day, and all they can find is this exploded snake with its head missing. It turns out the alligator regained its wits while still in the snake's stomach and clawed its way out from the inside. Bad mistake, snake. You wouldn't get a horse doing that.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, thank you very much, Matt. Now we're going to hear about the Compass of Mystery Festival, which is going on in Bristol over in the eastern area of the city right now, up until the 19th of October. But here's Sam King being interviewed by Anthea. Take it away.
We have Sam King here, and we're going to talk about the Compass of Mystery Festival. It's going on at the moment in Bristol. Hello, Sam.
Hi. Shall I just talk about it?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, we had our launch on Saturday 27th, last weekend, and it went really well. We're holding the festival this year at the Myvart Street Studios, which is an artist resident studios in Easton. It's actually really interesting history to it. It used to be a Victorian factory, and it's quite a labyrinthine space in itself. It really suits the theme this year.
What sort of factory? Is it a bit like the tobacco factory?
I'm not sure what they used to produce there. It's just that it sort of reeks of history, really. Yeah. There's lots of kind of strange doors going off to all the different studios. You're never sure which part of the building you're in. And that was one thing that attracted us about holding the festival there this year.
Is it easy to find? Can you tell us where to...
It is. That's a good point, actually. It's a bit tricky to find. If you know Easton at all, you'll know the St Mark's Road. It's a turning off of that, Myvart Street. If you don't know Easton, it's best to probably go to our website, which is www.compass-film.co.uk. And there's directions on the website to the venue. So it's basically easiest to go there.
So every year you choose a different theme.
Yes.
Why mystery this year? What drew you to that particular theme topic?
I think it was a theme that would be accessible to people, but also meant that we could do a lot with it. This year we decided to incorporate lots of different arts into the programme, as well as film. Traditionally, we've held two film festivals in Bristol so far, at the Watershed and the Arnolfini. And this year we decided to expand the programme, move it away from the town centre, move it away from traditional venues, and incorporate theatre, music, visuals, arts, poetry. And it's been really fun, actually.
Are you still attracting large audiences, though? Because you have moved away from the city centre. Are people prepared to come down to Easter?
Yes, in fact, we were really, really happy with Saturday. It was our launch event, and we at all times had a really busy crowd in there. It was a really nice mix of people with their kids, older people, young people, and we're hoping that will continue throughout the festival.
So would you describe it as a bit like a fringe festival, like the Edinburgh Festival, or not? You know, where people are putting forward exciting new ideas, it's not sort of conventional.
I wouldn't say it's on maybe the scale of the Edinburgh.
Well,
this year we have had more opportunities for people to get involved and actually participate. The whole theme of the festival this year is about community participation and involvement. And a lot of the aspects of the wider arts have been open to the community and getting involved artists. And the Theatre Slam is actually on the Friday the 10th.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Friday the 10th.
Which is this weekend. And it's an opportunity for people to register if they want to in advance. And it's sort of taster performances. Last week we had our youth poetry event. And then we've also got another element of the festival, which is open to submissions on Sunday, which is circa and burlesque, but I think we're looking pretty full on those now. We've got a lot of involvement from various different places, and it looks like a really diverse programme, actually. It looks really fun.
So how many people the maximum number of people that can go at any one time to these performances, is it limited, or...?
It's the maximum capacity of the venue is 150 people. That's the part of that, so the performance area, and then there's obviously all the bar area, which people can just go and chill out in if they want. Actually, the venue is another interesting part of the festival this year. We've decided, with the freedom that allows us, we're using this unused space in the MyVart Studios. We've actually created a whole sort of creative world and decked it out with different installations and themes for all the different parts of the spaces that we're using. We've got Narnia. We've managed to get our hands on 35 fake Christmas trees and decks out an area with fur coats and Narnia feel. Then we've got a kind of creepy living room area that you walk through. And then we've got, sort of all lots of decoration. It's been really great at getting people involved in helping us build the space this year.
Now, later on, you will be having a film festival, will you?
Yeah, so people that have been to Compass before will know that we have our traditional, it's the Compass Film Weekend, where we pick four countries from four corners of the globe and explore film within those countries. This year, we've actually chosen the countries based on the residents of Bristol and who represents Bristol. And the four countries are Pakistan, Somalia, Poland and Argentina. And we're incorporating local film as well into the screenings, as well as feature films. And you can check out all of the films on our website again at www.compass-film.co.uk. And it's been great. We've been involved with the Watershed and the Bristol Stories Project. We've got a few of those to screen, and some of the filmmakers coming down. And we've still got critical discussions beforehand, before each of the feature screenings. The Saturday the 18th, is going to be a big one for us. It's the first ever Pakistani horror film called Hell's Ground, which has toured the festival scene, but it hasn't had a major release in the UK. I think it might be screening at the ICA soon in London. And that should be a really, really fun event if people want to come down.
So would any of the directors of the films be here to promote their films?
Unfortunately, because we're a grassroots community festival, all of our what little money we have has gone on building the space and taking on things like screens and projection and technical setup, which obviously we were allowed when we were given when we were using traditional venues. That's another aspect of the festival. It's completely volunteer-led. We really rely on people to donate their resources and services, and that is made it work. And so thank you to everyone that has been involved.
So what happens after the festival to the building? Is it an empty building you've taken over?
It's an empty building in terms of the space, the actual space that we're using, that isn't used ever. Obviously, there are artists and residents in the rest of the workshop spaces in the building, but hopefully that will provide... They have the Mive Art Street Studio open day each year. This year they weren't holding it, and I think they are planning it in the works of planning it this year for next year. So so look out for that, because it's apparently really, really great. I'm going to make sure I go to it next year.
So next year, what theme? Have you decided on the theme for next year, or is it too early?
We're toying around with a few ideas. No, we haven't decided yet, so any suggestions, more than welcome. And I think we'll continue to use unused spaces in Bristol. It's been really fun and challenging this year doing that, and I think it's much more suited to our profile and what we want to do. I think we may move it potentially down to Montpellier next year. But who knows, we'll just have to see what happens.
Oh, well, good luck with the festival.
Thank you
for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Anthea, and thanks for coming in, Sam. That was the Compass of Mystery Festival going on in Easton right now up until the 19th of October. And here's David Bowie. We'll be right back. I have got a pair of red shoes, but I haven't got them on me, so I can't put them on, I'm afraid. But that's Let's Dance by David Bowie. Now it's time, a bridge especially for Dialect Radio by Malcolm Grieve, the actor, his reading of Cider with Rosie.
Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee. Granny Trill and Granny Wallen were traditional ancients of a kind we won't see today, the last of that dignity of grandmothers to whom age was its own embellishment. The grandmothers of those days dressed for the part in that curious but endearing uniform which is now known to us only through music hall. And our two old neighbours, when setting forth on errands, always prepared themselves scrupulously so. They wore high-laced boots and long muslin dresses, beaded chokers and candlewick shawls, crowned by tall poke bonnets tied with trailing ribbons and smothered with inky sequins. They looked like starlings, flecked with jet, and they walked in a tinkle of darkness. When I finally became king, I used to think, I would command a parade of grandmas, and drill them, and march them up and down, rank upon rank of hobbling boots and nodding bonnets, flying shawls and furious, chewing faces. They would be gathered from all the towns and villages and brought to my palace in wagon loads. No more than a monarch's whim, of course, like eating cocoa or drinking jellies, but far more spectacular any day than those usual trudging guardsmen. In spite of their formal dressing up, the two old ladies never went very far. Now and again to church for the sermon, and to the village shop once a week. Granny Wallen went for her sugar and yeast, Granny Trill for her tuppence of snuff. Snuff was Granny T's one horrible vice, and she indulged it with no moderation. A fine brown dust coated all her clothes, and she had nostrils like badger holes. She kept her snuff in a small round box made of tin, and worn smooth as a pebble. She was continually tapping and snapping it open, pinching a nailful, gasping, ah, flicking her fingers and wiping her eyes, and leaving on the air a faint, dry cloud, like an explosion of fungoid dust. The snuff-box repelled and excited us boys, and we opened its lid with awe. Reeking substance of the underworld, clay-brown dust of decay, of powdered flesh and crushed old bones, rust scrapings, and the rubbish of graves. How sharp and stinging was this fearful spice, eddying up from its box, animating the air with tingling fumes, like a secret breath of witchery. Though we clawed and sniffed it, we could not enjoy it, but neither could we leave it alone.
You owe me snuff again, you boys. I'll skin your bottoms, I will.
We looked up guiltily, saw her cackling face, and so took a big pinch between us. Choking tears and head-rocking convulsions, we rolled across the floor. The old lady regarded us with pleasure. Our paroxysms shook the house.
That'll learn you, I reckon, you thieving mites. Here, give it to me, I'll show you.
She took up the box and tapped the lid, then elegantly fed her nose. A shudder of ecstasy closed her eyes. She was born very far away. For several more years, the lives of the two old ladies continued to revolve in intimate enmity around each other. Like cold twin stars, linked but divided, they survived by a mutual balance. Both of them reached back similarly in time, shared the same modes and habits, the same sense of feudal order, the same rampaging, terrible god. They were far more alike than unlike, and could not abide each other. They arranged things, therefore, so that they never met. They used separate paths when they climbed the bank. They shopped on different days. They relieved themselves in different areas and staggered their church-going hours. But each one knew always what the other was up to and passionately disapproved. Granny Wallen worked at her flowering vat, boiling and blending her wines, or crawled through her cabbages, tapped on our windows, gossiped, complained, or sang. Granny Trill continued to rise in the dark, comb her waxen hair, sit out in the wood, chew, sniff and suck up porridge. Yet between them, they sustained a mutual awareness based solely on ear and nostril. When Granny Wallen's wines boiled, Granny Trill had convulsions. When Granny Trill took snuff, Granny Wallen had strictures. And neither let the other forget it. So all day they listened, sniffed and pried, rapping on floors and ceilings, and prowled their rooms with hawking coughs, chivying each other at long range. And to me, they both seemed everlasting, deathless crones of an eternal mythology. They had always been somewhere there in the wainscot, and I could imagine no world without them. Then, one day, as Granny Trill was clambering out of her wood, she stumbled and broke her hip. She went to bed then forever. She lay patient and yellow in a calico coat, her combed hair as fine as a girl's. She accepted her doom without complaint, as though some giant authority, squire, father, or God, had ordered her there to receive it.
"I knowed it was coming," she told our mother. "After that visitation, I saw it last week sitting at the foot of me bed. Some person in white. I dunno..."
There was a sharp early rap on our window the next morning. Granny Wallen was bobbing outside.
"Did you hear him, missus?"
she asked knowingly.
"He been a screeching round since midnight."
The death bird was Granny Wallen's private pet and messenger, and she gave a skip as she told us about him.
"He called 3 or 4 times, up in them yews. There's going, you mark my words."
And that day, indeed, Granny Trill died, whose bones were too old to mend. Like a delicate pale bubble, blown a little higher and farther than the other girls of her generation, she had floated just long enough for us to catch sight of her, had hovered for an instant before our eyes, and had then popped suddenly and disappeared forever, leaving nothing on the air but a faint drying image and the tiniest cloud of snuff. The little church was packed for her funeral, for the old lady had been a landmark. They carried a coffin along the edge of the wood and then drew it on a cart through the village. Granny Wallen, dressed in a shower of jets, followed some distance behind, and during the service she kept at the back of the church, and everybody admired her. All went well to the lowering of the coffin, when there was a sudden and distressing commotion. Granny Wallen, ribbons flying, her bonnet awry, fought her way to the side of the grave.
"It's a lie!" she screeched, pointing down at the coffin. "That baggage were younger than me! 95, she says, ain't more than 90, and I gone 92. Dig up the old devil! Get her brass plate off! It's insulting the living church!"
They carried her away, struggling and crying, kicking out at her steel-sprung boots. Her cries grew fainter and were soon obliterated by the sounds of the gravedigger's spades. The clump of clay falling on Granny Trill's coffin sealed her with her inscription for ever, for no one knew the truth of her age. There was no one old enough to know. Granny Wallen had triumphed. She had buried her rival, and now there was no more to do. From then on she faded and diminished daily, kept to her house, and would not be seen. About 2 weeks later, of no special disease, Granny Wallen gave up in her sleep. She was found on her bed, dressed in bonnet and shawl, and her signalling broom in her hand. Her open eyes were fixed on the ceiling in a listening stare of death. There was nothing, in fact, to keep her alive. No cause, no bite, no fury. Her down under had joined her up atop, having lived closer than anyone knew.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
I'm a dirty old man, the mean streets are home, my life is cold, I'll chew you to the bone. never care. I carry traces of death in my hair. You know my breath stink, I leave shit everywhere. So be aware, I'm unfeeling, don't you dare try appealing to my better nature. You better wait, you're misinformed. Ain't nothing warm about me, cold and gray. Concrete, clay and steel, and what else is real? I mean the actual deal. People seem to love living under my heel. Some of them call me London, I'm also known as New York. Anywhere in the world you'll find me, I talk the same bad talk, walk the same walk from side to side. You're transparent to me, there ain't a thing you can hide. Derive glamour from the stamina it takes to survive. You think I didn't know, it's all over your face like a rock. Now give me your cash and go before your heart break. You're living under my wing, and all you got I'm gonna take. I'm a dirty old man.
That was Dirty Old Man by Faithless. Time for Tony Gosling reading The History of Theatre in Bristol in 9 parts. Today, part 9.
A man came to me at a fair and said, "If you've a poet's tongue, tumble up and chant the air that the stars of the morning sung. I'll pay for you if you sing it twice a penny piece." I answered flat, "Sixpence is the proper price for a ballad such as that." The story of the Bristol stage from 1490 to 1925, serialised in 9 parts from the book of the same name by Miss M. Board. Part 9, The Actors' Church Union. In those days, stars toured with tiny personal company of their own, composed of 2 or 3 artists. The star, who had been present at Bristol when Irving made his application, went to Sunderland and there had need of a male juvenile. Irving was remembered and sent for. So began one of the most famous careers of modern times. A thrilling subject for research is the actual ground upon which the old theatre is built. The present stage door opens onto a lane, the old name of which is Rack Hay. It is thought that these fields held racks for the stretching of cotton or flax. Bristol's glory is in her theatrical history. We have an unbroken management since 1726. Hippisley, before that date, had a theatrical booth in Bridewell Lane. He took his company in 1726 to Jacob's Wells. His daughter, who succeeded him, went with the company to their new theatre in King Street in 1765, the management being members of the old Jacob's Wells Company. After world-famous history-making, the theatrical company of the Theatre Royal passed under Mr. Shute's management to the Prince's Theatre in 1867. It's a remarkably fine record, and when we consider the stage in Bristol as it is today, we feel both thankful and proud. Here, at last, our large city is well entertained. The Prince is still under the beloved management of the Shutes, the little theatre giving us repertory, and the old Theatre Royal once more in devoted hands under a fine and skilled management of Mr. Douglas Miller. The Actors' Church Union. The life of actors in the old days was unbelievably hard after cold, interminable journeys, sometimes a day and a night on the rails. Often without food, the actors would arrive at their lodgings. Theatrical lodgings have become a proverb. In all departments of life, artists were overcharged. When they were in towns acting, night after night they came home late, too tired to go to bed. To cold, strange lodgings, often dirty and uncomfortable and dear. Generally they had not a friend in the town, no one to turn to in their need. It was a very usual thing for them to be almost without food for periods. If the artists had no private means, they could obtained credit from lodgings that knew them. During their next engagement, they paid off their debt for their period of inactivity. It was impossible for the majority of artists to save. Their extraordinary kindness to each other is an astonishment. It was their love of their art that sustained them throughout their troubled lives and enabled them, at the end, to count the joy of art to be far better than all they had sacrificed. To better these conditions, the Actors' Church Union was formed. The aims of the society are to endeavour to meet the needs, religious and social, of the members of the theatrical and variety profession on tour, to look after the sick, to keep a register of apartments that can be thoroughly recommended to artists, and to undertake such other work as may be found useful and welcome to the profession generally. In Bristol, the society is most active. Each theatre has its chaplain, and friendship is accorded to all artists, and efforts are made in every possible way to see to their happiness. A great feature of the Bristol branch is the delightful Peter Pan Christmas party, which Mr. and Mrs. Fortescue Harrison, in collusion with Reverend Fred Norton, inaugurated under the auspices of the society. As many as 140 artists at one time have been guests on this occasion. It's impossible to say what this means to people in a strange town on Christmas night. Miss Mary Graham is Honorary Secretary, and she and her enthusiastic band of helpers have done splendid work. The result of their efforts is a general raising of the level of theatrical life and happiness, with good results to actors, managers and the public. That was the final part of the story of the Bristol stage, 1490 to 1925, by Miss M. Board. The Avon Association of Drama covers the Bath and North East Somerset, Bristol, North Somerset and South Gloucestershire areas. It publishes Prompt magazine 10 times a year. Other activities include festivals, playwriting, open air and touring productions, publicity and training. Individual membership and subscription to Prompt is £10 a year. The Avon Association of Drama's website is at www.avondrama.co.uk. Mark Graves is subscription secretary on 01454 238 384.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gosling. Well, a positive end there, because last week, of course, if you remember, it was rescued, the Old Vic, that is, from a terrible fate of being turned into a bacon factory. Interesting to hear about the hardship of actors. I remember reading Michael Caine's autobiography some while ago. He said in the days before he became famous, he had so little money that at one stage he only had custard powder to eat for an entire week. Did he issue forth yellow number twos, if you ask yourselves? I don't know, but it doesn't sound like a very healthy diet. And now, without further ado, it's time for Jeff with his What's On.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday 10th of October, and at Ye Old Farmhouse in Bath, Mean Red Spiders will be performing. Entry is free and the gig starts at 9 p.m. On to Saturday 11th of October, and at the Prom Bar in Bristol, Blues Cowboys will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and this week I feature Silver Ginger 5. Now, this group was formed by Ginger of the Wild Hearts in 1999, and the album Black Leather Mojo was first released in Japan in 2000 and had a UK release in 2001. This track is from that album and is titled Too Many Hippies in the Garden of Love.
Yeah.
That was Silver Ginger 5 with Too Many Hippies in the Garden of Love from the album Black Leather Mojo. Staying with 11th of October and at the Cheese and Grain in Frome, Walter Trout will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £13.50 in advance and £15 on the door. Finally, on a Sunday 12th of October at the Tobacco Factory in North Street, Bedminster in Bristol, Sweet Laredo will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
That was his bespectacled magnificence, Jeff Sparks, retreating from the microphone like a warship fading into banks of cloud. Well, that's it for this week's show, but we're back for the 14th of October edition, Tuesday next. Thank you very much to Tony Gosling and Anthony Page for their features today. And Tony also read the History of Theatre in Bristol. That's the end. No more of that. All nine parts read. Thank you very much to Dr. Nazim for being interviewed and for his contributions, and also to Samantha King. Just to plug the Compass of Mystery event, that's www.compass-film.co.uk, or you can always Google it if you forget that. And that is the Compass of Mystery Festival going on in Bristol up until the 19th of October, so check that out this weekend. Also, thank you to Malcolm Grieve, who's done an excellent job on abridging and reading out The Cider with Rosie, and that's continuing next week. The show was engineered by Village Church Curran. Thank you to Matthew Heap for his Matt's Muses and Jeff Sparks for his What's On Guide. I've been John Peters Coleman. Have a very good week and take care of yourselves.